Welcome to Cascade Church Podcast,
a church we hope is both safe to be and safe to grow.
Enjoy!
Good morning to y'all. Oh, wow. Thank you, Sam. Wow. Worship and a pulpit move. That is incredible. It's good to see you all. My name is Kurt. I'm a co-pastor here at Cascade. And I'm excited this morning because we're going to start a new message series. And we're going to do it on a book in the First Testament. Just so you know, kind of in general, how we like to do our message series here, something we always want to come back to the stories of the Bible as kind of our central location and grounding within the Christian story and tradition. It is this thing that's been passed on for hundreds, thousands of years. And these stories are the thing that we come back to because there's something about revisiting these stories that we find they speak to us in different ways at different stages of our lives. And so one of the questions that we have this morning is, how does this story speak to me today? How do I understand these stories of scriptures in new ways today? And so how we try to do things in general is about half the time, we just want to start with a book of the Bible, and we want to use that as a place to understand, what does that mean for my life today? What does that mean for the world that I live in today? And sometimes we want to look at issues maybe we're facing or things that are happening in society or in our lives personally, and then say, what are these stories or understandings in the Bible that we go back to? So it's kind of a different directions. Either we're going to start from the Bible and talk about how does this apply to our lives, or start with our lives and go to the scriptures and look at them. And so we are going to go to the Bible. And we are going to go to the most wall-building book of them all. We're going to be looking at Nehemiah this morning. I encourage you to not start Build That Wall chants. I don't know if you've heard, but it means something different today than maybe it did with Nehemiah in his time. But what I want to do is we're going to kind of look at Nehemiah. And then we're going to take a step back and see, how does this story fit into the Bible and all these different stories? I think it's helpful to kind of locate it within its history. So the first thing that I want to do is to say, why did we pick Nehemiah of all the books of the Bible? If you don't know, it is the story of rebuilding. It's a story of what do you build after deconstruction? And not to get too cute with metaphors at a church that's very familiar with deconstruction language, but I think it's helpful to say, what does reconstruction look like? There's something about, like, if you drive around, especially Portland, there's something about new construction that's a little too cute and tidy. Reconstruction is very different. We went, and this is going to tie to something else I'm going to talk about in a bit, but we went to Amsterdam years ago because my dad's family immigrated over from the Netherlands. So to get in touch with being Dutch in that. And when you go to Amsterdam with all the canal houses, what's fascinating is that the rules in Amsterdam are you cannot change the exterior of the buildings. Those have to remain intact. And they're doing a lot of work to protect the exteriors and the history in Amsterdam. That makes it incredibly challenging. In the United States of America, especially in the West, we're like, what is that, 50 years old? Tear it down. Get rid of it. That was for when people were like 5 foot and needed the tiniest of bathrooms and closet spaces. We've grown as a people, and so have our bathrooms and closets to match. It's difficult to play within the structure of what does reconstruction look like, because you're still building off of an old footprint. So how do we understand and reimagine that? It's also a story about what do we do with privilege and power. We'll get into what I mean by that, but sometimes we have in our lives, we have opportunities or we're given experiences or some amount of privilege within maybe our job, our role, our position within our family, of other people around. And one of my favorite things to clock is, like, if you ever go to a store or a restaurant or maybe like a rental car line and you watch people in a long line and you watch how they behave when they're in the midst of the long line. Like, you've got to be kidding me. This is taking forever. Are you seeing this person up there? It's like the first time they've ever gone through a line. And then when they get to the front of the line, they're like, well, 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 choices, choices, choices. Time slows down when you're at the front of the line, right? You forget about that past in the line life that you used to live when you had no opportunities and you were just stuck looking at the head of the person in front of you, right? Like even that little bit of power and privilege, the question is, what do we do with that? Do we remember the people behind us in line when we get to the front of the line? And do we behave in such a way that honors their presence in the world, or do we forget about them because that is from time past? That's also a theme that is going to be explored in Nehemiah. So, what I want you to do is if you have a Bible app with you, I encourage you to pull it up. We're going to be looking at Nehemiah 1. And again, I try to say this a lot. The reason why I think it's important to read along is I don't read everything. And there's something that you might find in there that I'm not talking about that I love for people to explore and read. So we're going to be looking at Nehemiah 1, 1 through 3. The words of Nehemiah. While I was in the citadel of Susa, one of my brothers, Hanai, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them about the Jews who escaped and those who had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. They replied, "The remnant there in the province who escaped captivity are in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been destroyed by fire." It's a great way to jump into a story. You can see we're already in the middle of another story. There's something happening where there's destruction, people are feeling great shame, and there's someone who's looking for news of it. What's happened to my people? Where has everyone gone? So I want to talk for a second about how this fits into the Bible. If you don't like this, this might be boring, and this is going to be a very begats section of the message. But I think it's really, really helpful because a lot of times we hear these stories if you grew up in church, or if you haven't grown up in church or you just hear these Bible stories as kind of unconnected sections, little one-off stories, but they're all connected. And one of the things that's really important is what is the story that a group of people tells about themselves? How do they understand their own history? I mentioned before that I'm Dutch. Like that's the aspect of myself that I identify with the most. What I think is fascinating is that within the story of the Dutch people, what I most often identify with is that my grandparents were in the Netherlands when World War II broke out. And they were actually engaged before the war, and they weren't married. They were just engaged the entirety of World War II as my grandfather and my grandmother were working at different parts on behalf of the Nazi army. And only after World War II did they get married, have my Uncle John, and then move over to the United States of America. I love telling that part of my people's history, of resiliency in the midst of being occupied, of resisting. My middle name is named after a distant relative who was a part of the Dutch resistance, who was killed as a result of it, fighting the Nazis in the Netherlands. Now, what I think is interesting is the other part of the Dutch story that I don't identify with and don't talk about is the Afrikaners down in South Africa. It's the Dutch people that come down and institute a rule and institute apartheid and separation that Nelson Mandela has to fight against. Both of those are a part of my lineage. Guess what part of that story I like to highlight? It's not the oppressor story. And so I also think it's important when we're looking at the stories of Jesus. Jesus is a Jewish person. What are the stories they told about themselves? And how did they understand themselves as a people? So let's go to the beginning of that, right? We start with Abraham. Some of you thought we were going to go with Adam and Eve. Kind of, but we're going to take a step after that. Abraham, who is identified as the father of the Israelite people. If you're a kid who grew up in church, maybe you sang a couple rounds of Father Abraham, had many sons. Many sons had Father Abraham. What's so fun about that story is, no, he didn't. Did you know? Abraham had a son, Isaac, when he was 100 years old. So Abraham, this beginning of that, is actually a delayed start to the founding of the people. How do they understand that as a part of their identity? Promises spoken but not realized until much later in life, right? Isaac then has two sons with Jacob and Esau, right? These twins who fight against themselves. You have Jacob being his mother's favorite who dupes Isaac, his father, when he's in old age to get his blessing. Then out of Jacob, we have 12 brothers, the youngest of which is Joseph, who had this amazing, what would you call it? Technicolor dream coat, right? And if you love Broadway, you've seen this story, right? He they pretend to kill their brother, and they're like, a wild animal did it. But they sold him off to slavery. Really recalibrates, if you had siblings, how they treated you, right? Like, it was bad, but not sold into slavery bad. He goes to Egypt. He finds God's favor after lots of time. There's a great famine, and there's this incredible scene where Joseph, the youngest brother sold into slavery, is confronted with his 11 brothers who are begging him, without even knowing who it is, for food. It's a long, fun story, but he ultimately forgives them, and this brings the Israelite people into Egypt. They thrive in Egypt, so much so that they expand and start having lots of other people, that it freaks out the Pharaoh. And what does the Pharaoh do with his power married with fear? He enslaves them. And this is the start of the enslaved Israelite story, only liberated by Moses. Moses leads them out of Egypt into this 40-year period in the desert, in the wilderness, where they're experiencing God in incredible ways, but feeling and yearning for the days of slavery. It's a fascinating part of the Israelite story. What does it look like to have liberation, but long for captivity? Ultimately, they're led to the Promised Land, which I think is the funniest and biggest misnomer. If you track the Israelite story, when do they have the best relationship and understanding with God? It's not in the Promised Land. It's actually in the wilderness. But as they get into the Promised Land, which Moses never sees, this begins the starting of Joshua. Joshua leads them within this, but they have no king. And then after Joshua, we have judges. So the wild stories of like Samson, these other leaders who come up for a time to do a particular service to the people, and then they retreat back out. This doesn't work for the Israelite people. They ask for a king, and ultimately God relents and says, sure, you get a king. And then we have Saul, who does not do so well. And then he has his music man, David, who takes over for Saul. This is the beginning of the Davidic Empire, the Davidic series of reign with the Israelite people. If you're tracking this right, we have uncertain beginnings with Abraham to despair and famine, only to be liberated by the brother sold into slavery, only to get put back into slavery, only to go into a wilderness, only to get instituted in to a promised land, which has a ton of ups and downs, ultimately until King David, high point of the people. He's taken over by his son Solomon, takes over. We have the Solomon's beautiful temple. They get destroyed after this. And this is the start of the what's called the Babylonian exile. What happens, and this is a picture of an artist's idea of rendering what it could have been like, right? That they are, their fortified walls and cities are ransacked, and the Israelite people are forced to spread all out within the known world, right? This scattering of the people. But what they did at this time is that the Babylonians who conquered them took the young, promising, wealthy men, and they conscripted them into their service. So you have very different stories during this section of the Old Testament. You have the true wilderness of the people that are out there who they can only tell stories that like, hey, a long time ago, your grandfather and great-grandfather enjoyed the high point of what it is to be Israelite, to be God's chosen people, having rule and autonomy. And we have nothing now. This is where we have stories like Daniel in the lion's den. If you're familiar with the Daniel story, is that he's conscripted into Babylon to be a servant, and he's trying to figure out, do I assimilate Do I go along to get along in Babylonia, or do I hold on to my understanding and my history of who I am? And this is also the story of Nehemiah. So going back, Nehemiah is saying, remember, he's conscripted into the Babylon. He doesn't know what it's like for everyone else who didn't get that opportunity. So he's saying, what is it like for my people? How is everyone doing? And it's horrific. They have no city. They have no standing. They have no rule in and of themselves. And what's fascinating is that Nehemiah takes that understanding of the world and how the people that he's a part of have nothing, and he says, I'm going to use the power that I have. He was a cupbearer of the king, which is a funny way of saying he was poison control, you know? That's what being a cupbearer means. It was like, hey, you get all the wine, which is great, until they try and poison the king. And then it's like, well, let's not have that wine. And also, time for a new cupbearer. Nehemiah had incredible access to power. And it's fascinating to see, how does he use this? These are the stories of this portion of time of the Israelite people. What do you do with power? What do you do with privilege? It's followed by, we talked about Daniel. What does Daniel do with his power? It's followed by the story of Esther. What does she do with her power? Because their people at large don't have it. And so one of the things that we like to do here at Cascade is to have conversations with one another. And that's the conversation I want to invite you to have now. At this point, as we kind of talk about these ideas, concepts, where does Nehemiah sit? Is what do you do with power? Tucker, if we could put that question up. What do we do with any power and privilege we have? How have you used it, and how have you seen it used? And I know that for some of us, we largely identify as, I'm a person that does not have power and privilege. And while that can be largely true in many circles in your life, there are places where you do have power. Again, I just talked about those flitting moments where you're the first person in line of a long line, king for the day, queen for the day. You have all the power. In comparison with the other people, it might be temporary, it might be fleeting, but what do you do with it when you have it? And the other question is, maybe you've worked with something, a coworker who's gotten a promotion. How have they taken that promotion? With grace and remembering where they came from, or with the power of a petty tyrant, ready to flex the tiny bit of power that they have over others? And here's the one question is, I'm interested in it for you to talk about, like, just in general, how have you seen it? But really to reflect on yourself. What do I do with the power that I have? Often when it comes to power and privilege, what we do with this conversation is we're like, well, I don't really have any in comparison with person X. So let's talk about person X. Right? Who cares about what I do with my power? It doesn't matter. Let's talk about how many times does Taylor Swift get in a private jet? That's an interesting conversation. And while it is an interesting conversation, it kind of betrays the truth of it, which is ultimately, when people get more power and privilege, you know what they do? The same things that they've always done with power and privilege. And most people say, well, I don't use my power and privilege that way now because I don't have any. But when I get it, I'm going to be so generous. The amount of people that are going to fund all the charities of the world when they win the lottery that they have not bought a ticket for, it's overwhelming, truly. We just need a couple of you who don't buy lottery tickets to win the lotto, and then I think we'll fund everything. The reality is what you do with what little power and privilege you have is only going to be magnified when you have more. So how do we understand power and privilege? How do we see it in the world, and what do we do with it? So what I invite you to do is just to turn to the people around you. You can, if you want to do half the church in your group, go for it. That's fine. If you want to have a couple of people, if you want to give off the like, hey, I'm going to be silently journaling to myself, or I'm going to type into my phone, do that. You don't have to, this isn't forced extrovert hour. What this is an opportunity for you to be able to talk and connect with the people around you. If you do connect with the people around you, make sure to share your name and discuss. What do you do with power and privilege that you have, and how have you seen it used? If you could turn to those around you now. All right. As we gather back together, my co-pastor Sarah wants to talk about it. She said, we were just talking over there, and it's like, let's ask some people. So, yeah. What did you talk about in your group, Sarah?
I feel like I cannot share other people's words responsibly, but...
Sure you can. It was Katie.
Okay, nope. We were talking about ways that we've opened up other doors, like ways doors have been opened for us professionally, and then we could open it for others.
Ooh, that's a good one. Good one. Anything else that was shared in yours, experiences that you've had with that? One time I used my power and privilege to raise my hand in church and share when the pastor asked.
I was like, everyone's trying to not make eye contact. That was shocking. I just looked up here. Everyone looked down at the same time. Just so you know what just happened. Wow.
I also get it. That's
Jonathan
what I do.
Jonathan Cotton, do thanks so much. You're paid by Cascade. Here we go. Praise to you.
I see that hand. Yeah. So for those watching online, or if you couldn't hear, like, how do you practice inconvenience? Because there's something with every step and level of power and privilege, there's less inconvenience that you might have to encounter. So what does it look like to make sure that I'm going to be uncomfortable, and that's good? Yeah.
I like that. I don't like it when I'm doing it, though. I'm not going to lie. Like, yeah. Anyone else? I'm coming over here. Everyone's looking down again.
We do have a hand in the back. Yeah, oh, Jasmine?
Yeah, Jasmine.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real clear moment when you recognize, like, oh, I thought I was being empowered because of who I was, and this might be tokenism. You just wanted me on the board or in this leadership position for how it appears, but not my actual voice and representation for the other people I'm with. Yeah.
I was thinking in parenting, when you say, like, someone says something to your kid that doesn't feel very good, and then you just let it slide because you respect them or you're trying to not make conflict, if you're me. And then, but I've been thinking a lot about, like, the inconvenience piece of, like, what if I said to you, like, oh, actually, I don't really love that. Or you kind of, like, you help correct it but not shame that person. Like, you reframe the statement in a way that would feel better. Because, like, how you're empowering your kid is, like, you matter enough that I said something. That power shifts us. But me and the adult with the power in the moment, that's uncomfortable because it's conflicty. I don't know. I've been thinking about that with my 3-year-old. Big yeah. feelings at home. So that's what we're doing. Big feels.
Yeah, sometimes it could be helpful to remember when you were a kid and you probably had a moment where an adult spoke up in your defense.
Yeah.
That's an incredible moment where you're like, oh my gosh. And I try to get in touch with that because I'm the same way. Like, someone can say something to my kid, and I'm like, we'll repair this later. Yeah. There's no sense in getting conflict here now. But remembering, like, when I was a kid, I really wanted that, someone to speak on my behalf. Yeah.
Well, we changed right. the world.
We did.
There we go. Thanks for listening.
We hope you're able to join us on a Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. in person.
Have a great day.